Hello, hello. Welcome back to the What If Project podcast. My name is Glenn. I'm your host, and this is episode 291 of the show. And today we're talking to a new guest. His name is David Giles. He wrote a book called There Once Were Orange Groves. This is a book about a lot of things. One of the bigger topics in it is grief. And David was very gracious with me because we put this conversation off a bunch of times because I just wasn't in a place where I was ready to go here and talk about some of these things. And I've been sitting on this recording for a little while. I think we recorded it back in January, and I told him I was going to be releasing it in March, you know, to as a remembrance of my dad's passing last March. And this conversation was one of the first recordings where I shared some things, like about my grief, like in more in depth, not like just in a blog post or like in a solo thing where I'm just talking with the mic, like actually having somebody else on the screen interacting with them about this topic and having it recorded. This was like the first time. And so I felt myself at times getting choked up, like almost like short of breath, because I was thinking about so many different things. But like I said, David is a gracious, gracious man. He helped me a lot with this conversation and also just leading up to it. And this is a great book. It's a book that's written, it's a novel that's written in a way I've never seen any novel written before. I'm not a big novel guy, so I don't like really know if there's like a lot of this type of stuff out there. But I said to David, I've never read anything like this before. It really blew my mind, not just like the content, but the way that he pieced the story together is so well done. So especially if you're like a fiction nerd, you got to get this book. It's super, super good. But he talks about, goes into a lot of different topics. The characters deal with a lot of different topics that I think will be relevant to a lot of people who are listening to this particular show. So anyway, I'll put the links to David's book, his work, in the show notes. Also in the show notes are links to my books, Rethinking Everything, Emerging from the Rubble, and also Patreon if you want to support the show. That is a place where you can do just that. Also want to tell you that next week, I'm going to be sharing something with you, a new aspect of the What If Project website is going live next week. I'm sharing it out with my Substack/Patreon supporters this week, and I will share it with everyone else next week, and I will talk a little bit about it in the intro to the show next week for episode 292. We are getting close to 300, right? I mean, 291 episodes. We're in like the final countdown, which is crazy to me that we are approaching 300 episodes. And I don't know how long this thing will go. I mean, it's so funny because there's so many conversations I've had and I still want to have. Like, I have a list of people to talk to, people who are reaching out to me to come on the show. I mean, it's a great problem to have. It's just I wish there was more time. I have so many episodes that I have recorded and I have that I'm going to be recording. And I think in May, I might drop like 2 episodes a week in May. So maybe do like a Monday and a Wednesday thing, just because, again, I do have so many and they're all so good that I just want to get out there, you know, as the summer kind of hits. Once the summer hits, everything kind of slows down a little bit. So I'll probably do some episodes in June, maybe July, and then maybe go quiet in August. I'm not really sure yet. But anyway, so many good things. Episode 300 is coming. Brian McLaren will be on the show again for episode 300 to kind of celebrate with me, reminisce, and talk about his upcoming book, Life. I believe it's called Life After Doom, and it's coming out very, very soon. So anyway, all that to say, my friends, this is episode number 291. With the one and the only David Giles talking about his book, There Once Were Orange Groves. Enjoy.
Monday morning blues, I open my eyes and And I'm greeted by a cute little smile. The world is new with you by my side. Everything is beautiful Tuesday afternoon. I'm calling you home just to hear your voice on the phone. I think of you and I'm not alone. You are everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Today we're talking to David Giles. David has recently written a very unique piece of fiction called There Once Were Orange Groves, and he's here today to talk to us all about it. So David, welcome to the podcast. I love your book. I've been looking forward to talking to you.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. So before we get into the book, could you take a few moments to tell us a little bit about yourself? Who is David Giles? What sort of things do you spend your days doing? Tell us the things we got to know.
Yeah, I am an author now, officially.
Officially.
as mentioned, There Once Were Orange Groves, that's the first novel. I also really enjoy just like making music. This year, I have already released one album and one music video. And that's under my a band I have with a friend, TV Is Neat. We can talk links at the end. But yeah, I just always have really enjoyed making stuff, be that, yeah, music, the music videos, writing things, just always just had a constant desire to be creating something.
That's awesome. So what kind of music does your band play and what instruments do you play?
Yeah, when it comes to my music, I like lyrics and vocals are definitely the things I do the most of. I also do all the production. And then I also, though, I have a synthesizer. I also have a guitar. I have, yeah, an electric, an acoustic, and a bass. I'm not good at the bass yet. I'm tolerable at the guitar. But, you know, that's why I have a friend who can help me out with those places.
That's right. It's why you're not a one-man band, right?
I do also have a band where I'm the one-man band. And, you know, if you're a good enough producer, you could be an expert guitar and no
do
one
anything.
Yeah, it sounds like you're amazing at the guitar, even though you're actually just taking different 5-second clips and splicing them together.
That's right, putting on loops and stuff, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, I can't play any kind of music. I could turn on like the radio and do that kind of stuff, but that's it. I mean, I've tried a guitar, but like my finger started to hurt and I'm like a big baby, so I'm like, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, it's that really fun thing where it takes like a few months of playing before your fingers stop hurting.
Yeah.
And it's just not fun to deal
with.
I
don't want blisters on my fingers.
Yeah. I mean, keyboard is definitely like a very easy, I feel like it's a lot easier way because it doesn't hurt and you immediately get the results that, I mean, whatever you press, you get the results of.
Exactly. So. There's a noise that comes out. It sounds halfway decent.
Yeah. And it's not like, ooh, I was too close to the fret or too far away from the fret. Now it sounds like a bad version of that.
Right. Right. That's so funny. All right. So your book, there's a ton of stuff that we could unpack, you know, with the stories and with the characters. But before we get into any of that, can you talk to us about the like the genre of this writing? Because when I first saw that it was fiction, like I said before we hit record, I had this idea of what the book was going to be like, because I'm not a big fiction reader. I've read maybe like half of the Harry Potter series, then I just watched the movies after that. You know, I've read some other fiction books put out by Quire. I'm actually reading Rob Bell's new science fiction novel, which is pretty good. But this book is nothing like any of those things. And I think the Amazon description calls it auto fiction. And then somewhere else, I think online, I saw it described like it's meta fiction. So talk to us about this, if you would, like the type of writing that somebody could expect if they go listen to the show, go pick up the book. Like what are they getting into?
Yeah. So it is, yeah, as mentioned, it is an auto fiction novel. And by that, it is a novel that it's like the events that are happening to the characters are things that actually have like happened to me. It is like, I'm using fiction to it's very obvious that this is like me talking about my own life through these characters.
And you're working out some things in this story.
Yeah, exactly. But then on top of that, it's a bit more, the auto fiction becomes a bit more auto once you get to the point where it's also me writing about writing the story that you are reading and what I'm going through and what's going on with my life. And like, well, I lost my job. Time to find out what I'm how I'm going to survive now. And just like moments where I'm just willing to like completely just break that barrier and just talk with you, the reader, about what is going on in my life, what I want to be communicated by this book. Like a big part of the book is just like trying to communicate with other people and seeing if it's ever possible to really like understand someone else. And so I realize, you know what? Screw it. I'm just gonna break down that wall and talk with you directly to make sure I'm getting my point across.
So logistically speaking, how did you organize yourself when you were writing this book? Because the stories, which you could talk a little bit more about, is they kind of the story doesn't follow like a straight, neat line. It kind of jumps around the different parts of the story. And my mind operates in a very like systematic, organized way. And so when I was reading the book, it took me a little while to kind of catch on to, what you were doing with the story. But once I did catch on, like my immediate thought was like, oh my goodness, how in the world did someone organize themselves to organize the story of this book? Because in my mind, I picture myself, if I were doing this, having like all of these post-it notes all over the place with string going back and forth trying to figure out like how I'm going to tie it all together. Did you map anything out? Did you kind of just go in and just write and it just kind of ended up this way? Like what did that look like for you?
I did not do the post-it note thing at all. I,
We're very
yeah,
different.
I'll be honest. With the, so the book is in three acts. Pretty early on, so I'll say the original idea for the book was like, oh, I genuinely only wrote that first chapter in the book as a short story, and then I was like, I want to know more about her brother. I want to know more about Jacob, because I feel like he has a side of this that's probably also correct. And then so I wrote a scene with Jacob and then realized, hold on, there's another character in that scene that I'm also like, I also now want to know more about them. And I'm like, and my brain goes, make it about every single character that appears, give them a chapter. I'm like, no, I physically cannot do that. But I can just follow the two of them. And so I reined myself in and went, okay, this is what it's going to be. And then I at that point I knew the three acts. I didn't know how act one ended. I knew what act two was, but I didn't know, and I did know how it ended, and I knew what act three was, and I knew roughly how it would end. And I basically just had like five different points on a line and went, I could probably fill all of this in. And just let it kind of fill itself in as I would write. There definitely were a few things. I was like, hold on, wait, that doesn't work. There's a moment in the story where Jacob graduates college. That one did not line up with the timeline at first. That one took a lot to be like, wait, how does this? This is not fitting in. So that one took a lot, but after a bit of working, I was able to get that fixed. But it was not a thing that in the process of like when I was writing the first draft, I was like, I'm not going to be worried about that. I will worry about that when it comes time to edit, because Anne Lamott in her book Bird by Bird talks about like shitty first drafts. Just like just write it all out, get it out there, and you can correct that stuff later. And honestly, there weren't too many other instances where I had to do a massive correction like that. But it was definitely a different experience than I think a lot of people do, of just like the fact that I'm just filling in the gaps. But I would recommend that sort of thing if you're doing fiction, at least, of just letting the story take you where it wants to go.
That's hard. It's hard because I mean, for me, I don't write fiction, but anything I do write, I feel like I have this urge to edit as I go. Like I'll sit with a sentence for like an hour. You know what I mean? Just trying to like tweak it and edit it. And I've had to, even like when I was in school, so many professors said, just write it out, and then go back to it later and fill in those blanks. For whatever reason, my mind just gets stuck on something and I'll like start writing and I'll keep going, but then like four sentences later, I'm like, I gotta go back to that sentence because I feel like I can't keep going until I have this thing figured out.
I definitely have had like there are times when I'll get like that level of like obsessed with a line or like this is
Right.
I love this line, but
Yeah.
it's not perfect yet.
Yep.
I just I think what I've done in the past for that is just make and like highlight it and be like, okay, just I will have to get back to that. And then when I do, it's just like try the writing the entire thing from scratch, that
Yep.
entire like block to see when I get to that point if it's going to be the same. Because maybe it's the other stuff surrounding it. But
Yeah,
yeah.
put a pin in it and come back to it later, right?
It's definitely, but I definitely know like there are times when I'm like just staring at like, because I also, as mentioned, I write music. And so when it comes to lyrics, I've definitely had that where I'm just like, this song's perfect.
Yeah.
I just am missing this one line. And I don't know how to make that work. And I'm just like staring at that for, I don't know, it feels like hours, but it's probably only like 20 minutes.
Yeah. Now, as someone who writes music, like that's interesting parallel, I would think. Like, is there a lot of parallels and overlaps between writing music and like writing a story like this? Like, you obviously been writing music for a while, and this you said is your first novel. Like, is there any overlap there that you've noticed, or in the creative process, I should say?
I think it's more that like because I was in college, I was an English major, and I think that helped me think about my music in a way.
Okay, interesting.
I don't know if actually my music had made me think about writing. I mean, other than I there is a lot of different songs referenced throughout the book,
Yeah.
and I think like I think it made me think that, music is such a part of my life that is like, no, I have to acknowledge that it felt wrong just to let the scenes not have music in them.
Yeah.
I didn't intentionally pick out like four songs that were over 10 minutes long that I did not realize till after the fact. Whoops. But yeah, I think it's definitely more that like writing has taking like writing classes for like poetry and fiction help me think about music being like, okay, how do I want to put my words here? How am I communicating that? And I do think though the fact that the stuff I normally write is a bit more like lyrics, which is, just another word for poetry. I do think that probably did also that side of music probably affected my writing
Sure.
since I have had friends talk about like there are certain lines where like, wow, that is very poetic. I'm like, thank you. I'm
Yeah.
glad that it is, despite being fiction.
Yeah, definitely. So one of those poetic lines, early on in the book, you have this, you kind of recount this personal experience, and the line you say, you open up, you say, "Today I had an ending." And I think that's one of the poetic lines, a very poetic way to kind of open up this story that you're about to tell. And it immediately drew me in because thinking about my own life this past year, and especially these last 4 or 5 years, I've had a lot of what feel like endings for me. But the story you go on to tell is kind of about finally feeling like you could no longer be a member of this church that you once went to. So I was wondering if you could tell us maybe more about that experience, kind of take us into that story, that part of your life, because it feels to me, and I could be wrong, but it feels to me like a lot of the energy, so to speak, from the book and from these stories maybe stem from that moment or that memory or that ending in your own life. So if you could take us back into that part of the story and talk to us about what was going on there.
So yeah, that ending was it was a church I'd been going to for the last year and a half of college. It was like I loved going to that church. It was an Anglican church, and I was not raised Anglican. It was the first time I went, it was like, this is a lot. Oh my gosh. But there was it was like it was overwhelming, but it was still like there's a sense of peace in it somehow with all the rhythms. I do still really love the idea of having all those rhythms in the sermon. I think that is I love that. I think all the Lent the seasons that go through it is also really cool, and same with like the Lenten practice and that. But what ended up happening was on January 8th of 2021, we have the priest sends an email to everyone like, hey guys, we're switching off of Facebook for our hosting the live videos and moving to so and so because Facebook is against Christian values. And if he had sent this message 2 days ago, I would not have cared. No, 4 days ago, I wouldn't have cared. Mm-hmm. But because he sent this on January 8th, 2021, which is right after January 6th happened and there was an insurrection and Facebook then pulled Trump's account, it certainly implied that the Facebook standing against Christian values is Facebook banning Trump.
Yeah.
I sent him an email like, hey, this is how this comes off. And then he just sent a very defensive email. I sent up a follow-up like trying to explain like that because he didn't say he was against the insurrection. And then he never responded to my follow-up and I never went back. It was just like a very disappointing thing because he was someone who he was a priest. He was the priest of the church I went to, but he was also a teacher of one of my classes in college. And he was someone who had talked about the idea of like art being a means of protest. And he recommended us like read about how the Beatles led to the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
And like, it was like a very, just like, wow, this is really cool. I like this teacher. I respect this guy. And then that happening and being like, oh gosh. And definitely like the fact that during the pandemic, so many people went really towards fascism and all that stuff, like seeing that happening, that was, I mean, to some extent, that was probably a big influence on the aunt character of Brenda. Just like the fact of like, these are people that you love, but now you've drifted so far away. They've drifted so far away from you, or you drifted from them. And it's just sad, and you're unsure how to deal with these people anymore.
Yeah, there were so many times, like people in that, around that time where I felt like I thought people thought one way, but then I saw the things being posted, like on Facebook, things like that about the insurrection, about Trump. And I thought to myself, like, I don't understand why I thought there must be a disconnect between how, what I thought, where these people were and where I am. Like, I just, everything just kind of, I remember my mind having so many explosions reading people's posts defending this or going against it. It just blew my mind. But so many relationships, I feel like, were rocky after that. And I felt like that brought in a lot of endings, like you talk about in the story, where even if it was the ending of the way I thought relationships were, or the ending of the way I thought things were between me and other people or whatever, like it just felt like a lot of things ended around that time on the tail of the pandemic and everything else. It just was a very difficult, I think, heavy season of life for a lot of people.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. No, it was the pandemic really was just like, it was so bizarre seeing sides of people that I just never knew were there. And I think it was just a big thing. It's just lots of people who were they were afraid. And a lot of the alt-right being like, ooh, I can tell you who to be afraid of. And people bought into that.
Yep. Yeah. A lot of fear, right? A lot of fear on all different angles. A big theme in the book that comes across, I would say even maybe the main theme is grief. And this has been a big theme for me in my life because, as I said in our email exchange, my father passed away back in March. And so grief has really been my teacher for the last 10 months or so. And I could go on and on about all the things I've been learning and realizing about myself and some of the unhealthy ways that I've handled grief in the past. But I'm curious, like, as you look back on your own life and as you were writing this story, and these themes obviously came up with all of these characters and this being really the big theme in the book, what would you say are some things that maybe you've learned about grief in your life with your own losses, your own endings, and maybe even how has your like approach to grief maybe even evolved or changed over the course of your life as you look back on how maybe you used to handle grief, you know, way back when?
I definitely am gonna quote myself from the book, quote one of the characters of my
might
book,
as well
is, yeah
slow hanging fruit, take it.
One of them says, I don't think I grieve well, and someone else says, I don't think anyone does. And I think that is just sadly the case. I mean, maybe there's someone out there who does, but I mean, I definitely know that I still, like, currently I haven't gone through, like, since around that time, I'd definitely gone through a lot. The fact that my grandfather's death was like him dying, and I just needed to process it because I knew he loved me, but at the same time, he was kind of emotionally abusive. And so it was like, how do I deal with that? Where, how do I grieve for someone who has caused me harm? And then around that time as well, I was also just trying to process once again, the passing of, or so when my parent jumping for context, when I was in college, my parents ended up moving out of SoCal where I was at the time. And then, so they moved away. They took our pet cat with them because I didn't have a place for it when I was in a house of 11 guys. A 3-bedroom house of 11 guys, just for context. But so they took the cat with them, and he just escaped his harness when they were out, when they were getting gas. He escaped the harness, and that was it. And there was just that never any closure there, because for a bit there was like hope that they found someone in the area, like they were able to get in contact, and they put up lost cat signs, and so there was that hope, and then the hope just at some point fizzled out, and so it wasn't really ever a like way of actually grieving. It never really had that real full-on grieving that I wanted to. And during the pandemic, that was when it actually finally started hitting. Honestly, there were times when I also, when writing the novel, was quite a lived in a very large amount of different houses in different states. But I did end up at one point, I was living with someone who did have two cats, and it was genuinely every once in a while, like once or twice a week, just having like a, I don't know, an anxiety attack or a panic attack as I'm just like sitting down petting them, and like have to like sit there for like recenter myself and be like, nope, stop. Let's not do that right now. And I think the big thing is like grief is only bad because of how much you love the thing. And it definitely can lead to that feeling of, well, oh, well, then I don't want to get hurt, so then I shouldn't love things. And it's just like, no, you idiot, because that implies that the grief is a stronger force than that those years you loved that thing. And I know that's not true, even if I sometimes, like, in my head might agree with that. I know that's still not true, and that should not be the case. But I mean, I know there's always, I think, is that temptation to be like, no, I don't want to be burned by that again. I don't want to be hurt by that. But just being like, no, that's, you have to, because that's only the only way that grief ever hurts is because of how much you love that thing.
So it's easier, almost feels like it's easier to say it's just easier not to love at all because then I don't have to experience the inevitable pain of what's going to happen when I lose that thing or that person or that place.
And there is just that, like, a really bad desire to be like, how about apathy? And it's just like, no, that is not good either. I mean, at least partially, because if at that point all you have is apathy, the grief is the previous grief is still going to be there, and you're just not going to have anything to offset it.
One of the things I realized with grief, with my dad passing, remember when he passed away, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. I was at the hospital with my mom, and when everything was done and we were leaving, I was driving home and I was sitting in a red light, and I remember thinking to myself, I don't even know how to grieve. I don't know what to do with these feelings that I have, because I grew up in the church and I went to Bible college, seminary, and I pastored a church. And I began to realize that, like, all of my life, I've been conditioned, I guess, so to speak, that if you're going to be that person in that position, you have to, in a sense, somewhat have it together. That's what everybody expects. Like, you're the pastor, so you've got to have a good perspective on eternity, on life, and be able to handle, these things that come at you. And like the pastor's allowed to have an off day or off 2 days or off a week or a couple weeks, or maybe a month, but if that month rolls into 2 months and 3 months and a quarter and half the year, and the pastor's really struggling with stuff, and the grief is really heavy, people start to talk, and then all of a sudden it's like, is this really the right person for the job to be leading a church, when they can even kind of get their own self together? So in my mind, like, I felt like I conditioned myself to stuff away my grief. Like, if something would come up, I just have to feel it quick, but then stuff it away really quick and move on with my life. And that's what I did for so long. And I remember sitting at that red light thinking to myself, like, this is not a healthy way, because I feel like I can't, I feel like I have tears, but I can't even access them. Right? I don't even know how to get them, because I feel like they're there, but they're not coming out. And then I thought to myself, like, I have to give myself space to feel whatever it is I'm going to feel. Now, I'm grateful I get to work from home. So I do work for choir. I do work for other people with social media. I have my own podcast, things like that. And so I can kind of make my own schedule. People who I do work for are very, gracious with my time and stuff like that. So I was able to contact them and just say, like, I'm just going through heavy stuff and I just need to deal with whatever feelings are going to come up. And so I put the podcast on hold for like 5 months. I didn't do any recordings. And even when I started recording again, there would be days where, like, I mean, the grief just comes out of nowhere. And I have to say to people, like, I'm just having a day where I can't have a conversation with anybody. And so I just need to just not do this conversation today. Maybe we could do it sometime later, and then show myself some grace in that. And again, like, this was all just new feelings for me to explore, because I'm going to be 42 years old this month. I've never explored a lot. I've never allowed myself to explore a lot of these feelings that have come up as a result of losing my dad. And I began to realize that these are good feelings. Like you said, it hurts, but the feelings that are there show that the relationship that we had was meaningful. It was important to me, and that's a good thing at the end of the day.
And no, it's definitely, I think, especially like just even myself, just growing up as a male in the church, that's just not really, you're not really told how to grieve. You're meant to be the strong thing that
Yeah, you're not
those
supposed to
other people
cry,
can really, yeah.
right?
You're, and it's like, I know my parents never taught me this, but it was still just both just like because that's how it's portrayed in all media and that's how it's portrayed in by other people, like it's just you have to be that strong person, you can't ever be weak, and apparently it's weak to have emotions. And it's just, yeah, when it comes time to have them, it's just like what's going on here, how do I process this. And yeah, we just don't have a language for that even. I mean, yeah, the day my grandfather died, so I was working at a lab that ran COVID tests, and there was an extra day. We'd work an extra sixth day if we wanted. And I wake up, I'm getting dressed, and then I get the text, and it's just like, do I go to work or not? And I did. I was like debating, maybe I'd call out, maybe I call out, and I just drove to work. Didn't really process anything the entire time at work, and then driving home, just kind of started screaming, because I didn't know what else to do. And it is like, yeah, the immediate reaction I had was, okay, we're going to just ignore this. And it's like, I knew it wasn't correct, but also like, life doesn't, we definitely. There isn't really a place for that. Like, I know we get, like, legally, most companies have to provide bereavement pay, but it's still, like, not really what it's not really, there's not really a space to have grief.
Yeah, it's one of the things I was talking to my wife about, because I used to work for Apple for 11 years. And I remember that Apple, I think you get, when a parent dies, you get 1 week of bereavement. So you get 1 week off. And I said to her, I'm like, if this happened when I was Apple, and like I was allowing myself to go down this road of feeling this grief, I don't know what I would have done, because I looked at people who lost loved ones when I worked there. They'd be gone for a week, they come back, and the expectation was, okay, they might not be 100%, but even at like 90%, it's still, you got to go out on the floor, interact with the customers, do all the different things, put on a smile, be in a happy, good mood. And I thought to myself, like, Now, looking through the lens of my own experience, I'm like, how in the world can you expect people to do that? And I'm like, grief is not linear. You can't just tell somebody you have a week to grieve the loss of, a parent or even the loss of a child. People at Apple have lost children, and they have to come back and just go back to work. Like, grief, you can't just snap your fingers one day and like all of a sudden, okay, I've grieved and it's time to go back to normal. Like, it doesn't work that way. And I think that there is a real hole in the system, of our society, and maybe that's even a thing with capitalism, just because of the way things are built, that this it doesn't make room for the humanity of somebody dealing with a loss. And I think that that's a huge issue that a lot of companies, I think, need to address.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah, we could go down a whole another road on that one. But the other thing too, I mean, sitting at that light that day on my way home, I'd been dreading. First of all, I had been dreading this conversation, not dreading the conversation with you, but your dad had told me, I talked to Heath a lot, and he said, "Get ready when you read that book, because it's about grief and loss." I'm like, oh, great! I'm just gonna break up so many different things. And so I remember I started reading it, and you and I were supposed to talk earlier, but then we thank you for being gracious and putting this off a little bit because it wasn't a place where I was ready to talk about all this stuff. But sitting at that red light again that day, I was thinking back on when I was a pastor. And like you said before, very interesting. You said that nobody told you in your family that you weren't allowed to have these feelings or to grieve or to cry or whatever. But for some reason, those things get filtered into our minds, I think, especially as men. And when I was a pastor, I pastored a very old church. It was like everybody in the church could have been like my grandparent because it was such an older congregation. And in that first year, we had like, I think it was 15 or 16 funerals. Like, lots of people were passing away. And it was almost like people were like, Glenn comes here and all of a sudden everybody starts passing away, but it was like people were older. So people were old age. We had people pass away of cancer. We had one person who took their own life. And I remember there's this one week in particular where we had vacation Bible school, and then we had two funerals as well because two people passed away. So I had a funeral midweek that I had to do, and on Sunday after our big VBS Sunday where all the parents come and everything like that, we had a funeral right after that, and we also had like Bible studies, we also had prayer meetings, like all the normal stuff, Sunday school, and I was the only person, I was the only pastor, so I'm 26 years old, and all this expectations on me. And I said to my wife, after my father passed away, I'm like, I can remember having these feelings, like I'm these people who died, like I knew them, like I spent time with them, went to their house, we had lunch together, all different things. I felt a sense of loss, a sense of grief, but I couldn't cry because I was afraid, like if I cried, the floodgates would open up, and then I would be a complete mess. Like, how in the world am I going to do two funerals, meet with two families? Do all the vacation Bible school stuff, do the prayer meetings, the Bible studies, Sunday school, preach two sermons. How am I going to do all this stuff if I let these emotions come forward? And so the message that I got was, you've got to stuff it all away and you just got to move on with your life. And you stuff it away so long that you don't know how to do anything else other than stuff it away. So my first thought when my father passed away was, I've got tons of podcasts to do. I've got lots of recordings lined up over the summer. I got books to read. I'm going to throw myself into all of this work, just like I did back when I was a pastor. And I'm going to hide all of these feelings that I'm having, just kind of move on with my life. And so, like you said, you get very conditioned, I think, to operate that way. Even if nobody tells you that's the way to operate, that's how you filter your experiences.
No, definitely. Like, I know, my first reaction whenever anything like grief comes up is just like ground it in something else, find something
Right.
to just distract yourself in.
Anything, right?
No,
Yeah.
it's I wish I do wish I was better at grief, but I don't never learned. So hey, all things considered, for being self-taught griever,
Right. That's
I think
it. We're doing
I
pretty
can.
good. All right, so Act Three of the book, is this is one of my this is where I really love these parts of the book, like towards the end, where I think it's Audrey, I think is the character, and you're she meets you, the author, and you sort of like break the news to her that you wrote the story and that a lot of the story, like you said, really happened, even if it didn't really happen to her. Now, Again, like I don't read a lot of fiction, but this was like the first time I ever read something where the author wrote themselves into the story to kind of dialogue with the characters. So I thought that was really unique. But I love this one part of your interaction, and maybe you could talk about this. But Audrey's kind of like shaking her fist at you. She's like, "How dare you write my story like this?" You know? And then you say, even Plato knows that fiction is the best way to communicate." So can you talk to us about like the thinking? Because again, that's another very poetic line, but some of the thinking behind that statement, like how is fiction the best way to communicate, and what has that meant for you? What does that look like for you in your own life?
So that line is directed to the fact that Plato in Plato's Republic, the entire time he's talking about how fiction is just a substitute for re reality, and so fiction is so much less than reality. And then to prove his point, he uses the metaphor of the cave, which is him using fiction to prove that fiction is less. And so it's basically him defeating his own argument, like.
Right, the irony.
I love Plato for doing stuff like that. I know so many people dislike him, but I'm like, no, he's not trying to, he's just trying to make an idiot of all the other people he's arguing with while also making a fool of himself in the process. It's great.
He's the brilliant.
And so, yeah, just the idea of just being like, no, I'm gonna just, there's a part of it was just like, I thought it would become just a joke, a funny joke to some extent to be like, yeah, Plato, the person who everyone kind of like, people debate what he means by anything he says. I'm just gonna go ahead in the middle of the book and just make my statement on what he means. But I think part of like what I was trying to communicate with like talking to Audrey in this part was it like realizing I wanted to, because to some extent throughout most of the book, Audrey and Jacob had been stand-ins for me. And then by the time we get to Act Three, Audrey becomes more of a stand-in for the audience, for the reader. And it also kind of becomes a, just like, to some extent, a like quote, like a argument with God kind of thing of just like, you are like, it kind of is like the problem of evil and just trying to deal with that. Like, I, as a writer, have done bad things now to my subject. And just like trying to like explain why I would do that. And just like, especially because part of the thing is I did actually have friends read the first like act before they went on, before I'd even written the third. And so a lot of those questions were like things people had asked me about, like, wait, why would this happen? How could you do that? And so I think it was just to some extent just understanding that, like, yeah, like I need to communicate these ideas, and it's easier to communicate them using someone else. Like, that's why it's autofiction and not just autobiography. Because I think there, I mean, I think there's a reason why people are a lot more drawn to read a fiction book than, for the most part, a biography. Or there are, most people would probably be more willing to watch a movie versus watch a what's it called? Like an adaptation of a film, of like a person versus a documentary about the film. Like, it's easier for some odd reason for us to sympathize with people if we think there's a that layer of separation between the person telling the story and the person in the story.
I think that I really think that speaks to like the power of just of the form of story, right? Because like I think to again like back on my past as a pastor, so many times like I would spend so much time on a sermon and like crafting like particular st again like back to statements and sentences like things I want like an idea I want to get across like how can I best craft this statement? But the people would always remember the illustration I talked about, even if they didn't remember that well-crafted statement that I made, like in the application part of the sermon, but they would be like, I remember that story that you told about this time in your life and blah, blah, blah. And that just magnified for me that, story is so important. And for the Bible readers who are listening, and I think that's why Jesus used parables because he could have made a statement and said, well, this is what I want you to know, blah, blah, blah. But instead, he told a story, and the story
Yeah.
has so many different angles to it, and that can be so captivating where it takes your mind into the story, and you might even see something in the story that the storyteller didn't intend for you to see, but you saw it anyway when you looked at that story through the lens of your own experience.
Yeah. Death of the author is a very, very valid form of reading. And I know because I've definitely done it to my own writings. There's
Right.
definitely times when I'll write something and then something happens in my life and I'm like, oh, that doesn't mean what it meant when I wrote it anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't think if there's any specific instances in the book, but I mean, when I wrote the book, I was still in SoCal and I'd lived in SoCal my entire life. And then I moved up to the Pacific Northwest, and it's weird realizing that a lot of the things that Audrey is like feeling after she moves from SoCal to Idaho are the same exact thing I then went on to feel.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, it's really bizarre how art that's imitating life, and then my life starts imitating that art afterwards.
Right.
That did genuinely get a bit like, what am I doing here? What is going
Yeah.
on?
What came first? The chicken or
Yeah.
the
Yeah.
egg, right?
Very, very surreal moment.
Yeah. All right. So last question for you. Again, in your interaction with Audrey. You say that you, David, aren't sure that you've forgiven God, for everything he's done to you. And that feels like a very deep and loaded statement with a lot of emotion. So I was wondering if you could take us into that, kind of the thinking around that a little bit, because honestly, I think it's very relatable for people. I
Yeah.
think it can almost act as a permission slip, maybe for some of our listeners who are struggling to, forgive God, or maybe even better stated, forgive a version of God that they were handed when they were children. Because I think a lot of people, it's very easy. I know for myself, I hold a lot of grudges, so to speak, against that God that I had as a child. But even though I don't view God in that way anymore, I'm still harboring a lot of that bitterness towards that particular time in my life. So I'm wondering if you could unpack that statement a little bit for us
Yeah.
and what that meant for you.
Yeah. So I think a big thing is just that I think a lot of us grow up like, yeah, God's in control. Everything that happens is in his will.
Yeah.
And then it's like that, then you get to like an extreme Calvinism version of it as well. And but then like, and like, yeah, I know when I was growing up, like there's times when a bad thing would happen. I'm like, oh, and I can see the good that came from that. Like, because my family actually had two cats, and the one that died first, that one I do know, like, that was a thing I think needed to happen for me, because I knew I didn't, like, I kind of had acknowledged that my, I was kind of in that, like, I'm in the apathetic state that just wasn't willing to open myself up to anything. And then when she died, then it was like, I didn't cry. And it was just like, oh, this is bad. I need to work on this. And so, like that, there was like something good came from this when that happened. And then losing the second cat, just being like, I don't see any good that came from this. And like, well, I guess I wouldn't have written the novel if that didn't happen. But you know, a part of me still thinks I would have rather had my cat than have the novel, as much as I'm proud of this novel. And it's just like it's are definitely when you're told the entire life, oh, God makes everything good, and it's just like,
It's just
I don't know, I really don't know, especially if you look at the global world and not just our individual lives. At times it just doesn't always seem like that. And I think a part of it is, I think you don't have to just be happy with how your life turns out. I think there are things outside of your control, and you can find them upsetting, and I think it's okay to find them upsetting. And yeah, I mean, yeah, I still stand by that, despite like, yay, I have a novel, and I do think I can say that, yeah, my novel's probably reaching people who are now like thinking about grief in a way they hadn't before. I still would have preferred not to go through that. If I had the option to go like, and I now know what this, all that happened from my life, I'd be like, yeah, I can sacrifice that. I don't care. Like, I would switch to the reality where he doesn't get lost in an instant, and
Yeah.
it's still just kind of like, it's hard. I don't know if I'm like, it's just hard to really say like, oh, this is all for the best, and like the whole, oh, God has what's best planned for you and all that stuff. And
Yeah.
it just, no, things just kind, to some extent, things just happen and they suck.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I've talked on a podcast before. I used to have this idea that, God is all powerful and God is in control of everything, and God was like the puppeteer. That's just how I lived my life, and I just, well, things might happen along the way, but God has a string attached to that as well, and he can pull it and everything's gonna end up okay. And I mean, I had that feeling for that belief for the longest time, and then my wife and I, we had a miscarriage before our daughter was born, and I remember being with her in the hospital and going out to get the car and just yelling at God when I got in the car, like, how dare you allow this to happen? And I remember thinking to myself, like, all of a sudden, like, how can God be all powerful if and all loving if God allows this to happen? Like, there was just this huge conundrum in my head that, like, no longer did this piece of theology that was so systematically laid out in my theology papers all of a sudden fell apart when it was put up against a real life situation, And then talking about people like, I can remember when we had a really big hurricane a few years back down here, people are like, oh, the hurricane was supposed to come right to us, but God magically picked up the hurricane and moved it away from us, so our home is perfectly fine. I remember thinking to myself, yeah, but God moved it to someplace else where people lost their homes and like they're literally destroyed. There's like thousands of people who literally don't have a house, like it got carried away into the ocean. Like, but thank goodness that God saved your house. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me, but like all those years ago, it would have made sense to me because that's the way that I thought, that's the way that I was raised to think. But now I'm like, it doesn't. These things don't fit anymore. And I remember feeling so angry at that God because that God really let me down, because that God is supposed to be all powerful. That God's supposed to be all loving, but you weren't all powerful for me. You weren't all loving for me. So, like, what gives? And feeling really angry at that God. And I feel like even though I don't believe in that God anymore, that God still exists as a mental category in my head. And I'm really angry at that version God that I was given as a kid.
I also want to add that I think it's okay to be angry at that sort of thing, because I know it's a sort of thing where I, personal experience, you're going to be angry. It's going to pick a target.
Yep.
And it's probably better to pick that than to pick yourself. Like, it is so much easier. Like, I know, like, there was a teacher I had in the third grade who was, I felt like, was singling me out and, like, just intentionally, like, picking on me repeatedly. And it was a sort of thing where I, because I was so young when it happened, I didn't really realize or connect the dots. And so there was just a lot of self-hatred attached to a lot of those moments and those memories. And then when at one point I was talking with my mom about that, she mentioned like, yeah, mentioned that the teacher did that and how I'd come home feeling this way. And it was like, it feels weird to use the Christian language of, and I felt a burden lifted when I realized I need who to actually direct my hatred towards. But like, that's directing it to her allowed me to forgive myself for these things that I did not do, and it's then easier for in time to forgive her than it would be to just forgive yourself for that. And so maybe that's not the message that everyone really likes to hear or wants to hear, but I genuinely think, no, it's like, I think it's probably okay to be like, no, right now I'm gonna hate you, because it's either I'm going to hate myself for a long time, or I can hate you and then try to forgive you. Forgiving yourself is a lot harder.
That's a, often a lot deeper wound when you've got to go inside and forgive yourself.
And especially if you're not the one who actually did the thing, you're not going to find the cause, and you won't be able to really work on that.
Good stuff, my friend. Well, we're just about out of time, but this has been a lot of fun. Time went really fast. Well, thank you
Oh,
for taking time to join me. Yeah, go ahead.
yeah, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed that. I did not realize that was almost an hour.
Right? I just looked at the clock. I'm like, oh, I don't want to keep you all day.
Yeah.
Real quick, where can people go online to connect with you?
Yes.
Facebook, Instagram, any places?
I'm not really on Facebook, but I am on Instagram at David Giles Writes, DavidGilesWrites. And then you can find my music at 14 Days. That's spelled out FourtenDays.bandcamp.com. I do have three more albums coming out this year and three more music videos. And then also, I appreciate it if you guys went out and bought my novel, There Once Were Orange Groves. It's available on Amazon. And drop a 5-star review, you know, if you like it. Almost at 20 reviews, guys. Come on,
Awesome.
let's
We
do
can do
that.
it. Come on, listeners. Let's
But
get them
yeah.
up to 30, 40. Let's do
But
it.
yeah.
Awesome. I'll put the links in the show notes and we'll do it again sometime.
Yeah, sounds good.
Monday morning blues. I open my eyes and I'm greeted by a cute little smile. The world is new with you by my side. Everything is beautiful Tuesday afternoon. I'm calling you home. Just to hear your voice on the phone, I think of you, and I'm not alone. You are everything. Waking up with you in my arms, I've got it all, nothing's amiss. Everything is beautiful, Sunday morning snooze with breakfast in bed. And I listen to the song in my head, it sings of you and the things that you do, 'cause you're everything.